Welcome to Uncharted, an Arctic 360 podcast about the impact of COVID-19 on the North American Arctic. All summer long, we're talking to the people who live, work, and govern the Arctic to understand how we move forward from this moment in history. Today's theme is icebreakers, a special type of ship that's designed to navigate ice-covered waters and help guide other ships through. As you can imagine, in the Arctic, that's a very important and expensive task, and one that's changing as the climate crisis accelerates, and every northern country has their own approach to this. We're going to talk today with somebody who knows icebreakers as well as anybody. That's Spencer Fraser, the former CEO of Federal Fleet Services, with 20 years of experience in the Royal Canadian Navy. He's now the Director of Business Development for the Inosha Group, and that owns the Davie Shipyard in Quebec and the location of a recently announced Arctic Icebreaking Research Center. Today, we talk about the significance of this new center, as well as the importance of icebreakers for Canada's sovereignty, economy, and promise as a future northern leader. I'm Erica Wallace, and when it comes to COVID-19, this is Uncharted. Spencer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. I wanted to talk about icebreakers because honestly, it's a subject that I don't really know a lot about. And so I kind of just wanted to start by asking you sort of a really basic question, which is, what is the significance of icebreakers to Canada's Arctic strategy? And what do they enable us to do, and why do they matter?
Sure. So Canada's got a long history employing icebreakers. So as the name implies, you know, we've got ships that ply Canadian waters to break the ice to allow navigation by other ships. What's really interesting in Canada is that we've got effectively two seasons. We've got the Arctic season, the shoulder and summer and fall shoulder season, where our Coast Guard fleet goes to the north and breaks ice. And we also have the winter season, which is mostly on the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River, where our icebreakers break ice for merchant ships coming up and down the river as far as Montreal and then on the Great Lakes themselves to deliver goods and services. So in terms of Arctic strategy, though, specifically, the Coast Guard's icebreakers provide, there's a show of sovereignty by Canada. They do resupply of certain villages and coastal communities. They do a very important role of search and rescue. They maintain situational awareness in the north. And they're basically Canada's presence, most visible presence in the north.
How does our fleet actually compare to other northern nations? I mean, it seems like an essential for any northern nation to have a fleet of icebreakers. Is there one country that kind of is the model for what maybe we should be doing?
Well, interestingly, if you speak to some of Canada's top academics who study icebreaking and Arctic navigation, Canada kind of led the world up until the early 1980s, and then for a variety of reasons, we let that slip. So today, the Finns, the Norwegians, they're global leaders. The Russians obviously have a massive presence. And one of the reasons we've established the National Icebreaking Center is to regain, for Canada, a prominent role in icebreaking technology, the construction of icebreakers, the employment of icebreakers, and the training of staff and sailors who actually man them. So how does our fleet compare those specifically? The first thing to say is that we're very fortunate in Canada. We've got fantastic mariners in the Coast Guard. I mean, that has to go without saying. Right. Very experienced folks. Canada should be quite proud of what they do. But I think one of the challenges is that the staff, and I've spoken to many of them over the years, they can only go so far when they're employing old equipment. And we have to really take our hat off to them because they've been maintaining some of these ships that are quite getting on. You know, the Louis Saint-Laurent was our Canada's largest icebreaker. It was supposed to be decommissioned in 2017. She's still sailing. The sailors are doing a great job on board. But when you look at the average age of the Canadian Coast Guard fleet, it's getting up there, very close to 4 years. So I guess the what the data shows and what commentators are looking at is that Canada's got extremely professional sailors, mariners, and the Coast Guard, but it's time to renew the fleet, and there's some initiatives underway to do just that.
I have kind of a technical question, which is, can you turn a normal ship into an icebreaker, or is that something that has to be specifically designed?
No, unfortunately, it has to be specifically designed.
Okay.
And it's one of the challenges in the industry is that there's so many different nomenclatures used to describe what kind of ice they break, if it's first-year ice, if it's multi-year ice. And it's a very good question, Erica, because even some of our senior policy folks from time to time find it frustrating because we talk about PC1, PC2, all these different categories of ice breaking. But in a nutshell, you've got merchant ships that are not specifically ice breakers, but ice capable. Double-hulled vessels that can ply the waters of the north, and then you've got purpose-built icebreakers that going right up to nuclear-powered icebreakers, such as what the Russians have and what the current administration south of the border is indicating that they should also acquire, to smaller icebreakers that work just around coastal areas. So it's quite a complex subject.
Right.
But in short, you just have to think of it as there's ships that can navigate in ice around ice, and there are those that are purposefully there to work the ice and blaze a path for the ships behind them. And one of the other interesting things is that there are very, very stringent regulations about environmental mitigations that you have to now do for the north for bilge water, for waste management, very mm-hmm. stringent. And again, this is an area that we're looking at with the National Ice Breaking Center. There's some fantastic Canadian technologies out there. For example, Tarragona, Montreal makes a micro gasification system, and those cruise ships that have been going through Canada's Arctic are actually using Canadian technology so that they're compliant with the regulatory requirements of the north.
Oh, interesting. Well, and I imagine the requirements for, you know, these different types of icebreakers, that must change as the climate warms and the ice is shifting, right?
Yes, and there's this, I don't know if it's a paradox or it's a challenge, is that with the receding multi-year ice, the waters are actually counterintuitively becoming more treacherous, because what you're having is bergy bits, sections of multi-year ice break off and float into areas that they haven't seen before.
Right.
So if a ship hits a multi-year ice, I mean, everyone knows about the Titanic, but you can, even a multi or like a double-hulled vessel can sustain a significant damage. So we've got this, the requirements for icebreakers, if anything, is probably going to go up, because as the ice recedes and more areas are open to navigation, the waters are going to be particularly treacherous. So it's going to be a very interesting next 20, 30 years.
Interesting. How many icebreakers do we have in Canada?
Well, it's a very good question. And it gets back to your earlier question, how do you define them? So,
right.
We've got two large icebreakers, which are the Louis Saint-Laurent and the Terry Fox. Hmm. We've got then a multitude, a handful of 1200s that are used in the Coast Guard, and 1100s, and then we've got smaller vessels. So all in all, about 20 is what the Canadian Coast Guard is employing.
Hmm. Now, I feel like icebreakers come up a lot when we're talking about Arctic sovereignty and national security, but I'm assuming they have additional economic benefits as well. Like how does that play into northern communities, and what's the benefit to them?
Well, I think absolutely. I think you're right to point out, far too often we look at the Arctic through a national security prism. But at the end of the day, I think what all the recent reports are calling out for is how do we bring greater economic development and quality of life to our northern communities.
Right.
And so icebreakers play a multitude of roles. if you believe that, you know, first of all, the Northerners have to, you know, I have to categorically say, you know, it's Northerners have made it loud and clear that they want to be in the driving seat as it comes to Northern development of resources and extracting in a responsible way. Right. You know, they've got, you know, mining sector can be huge in Canada, and it's already significant in the north. So icebreakers, just to get ships in and out safely to take goods to market, raw materials to foreign markets, that's the most evident one. But also resupply, as I said, search and rescue, as activities increase in the north, well, you're going to need, Northerners deserve the same level of infrastructure that we have in the south. And icebreakers are one pillar in that. I mean, it's not just icebreakers. You've got to have proper deep water ports. There's a crying need, and COVID has shown us, for broadband connectivity. I don't want to suggest that icebreakers are a be-all and end-all of bringing prosperity to the north. They're one part of what has to be a bigger discussion about infrastructure, energy, port access, etc.
Right. You mentioned ports, and I feel like that's obviously a really integral part of this conversation. I'm assuming we need an expanded system to make icebreakers more effective in the north, right?
We do. And it's not just to make icebreakers more effective. It's if we believe, and I think the data is showing that, that in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, the traffic in the north is going to increase.
Right.
Ports, you know, port of call or a safe port for a ship that's in a storm. We need this basic marine infrastructure in the north for refueling, for effecting repairs if there's a problem, for staging equipment to respond to environmental disasters. It's just, it's funny, Erica, everything that we do in Canada in the south, that we, regrettably, I think we take it a bit for granted because it's just not a, it's not lacking, is what we need to build in the north, such that you know, northern communities have the same level of quality of life and economic opportunity.
Right. Well, I imagine, as you sort of mentioned before, like the process of building these icebreakers could be an economic opportunity as well. Like a lot of the resources must come from the north.
Well, and that's what we're looking at the National Icebreaking Center. So one of the recommendations in the Senate's latest report on the North, Northern Lights, a wake-up call for the future of Canada, they make a very clear recommendation that we have to build out our ice-breaking, ice management capability in the North. And that crosses a whole bunch of lines. So one of the things we're quite passionate about is bringing Canada to the forefront again of icebreaking technology. We've got phenomenal companies in Canada, but to your point, it takes about 7 to 8 years from the time you say go to get an icebreaker designed, built, tested, and ready to go. So it's not something that you can turn on the tap and you get immediate ships coming out the other line. Right. So and I think we're lucky in Canada. If you look at the supply chain in Canada, and this is why getting the dialogue between Northerners and Southerners to show this as an imperative for Canada, we have, as an example, Davie Shipbuilding's got 1,400 suppliers from Vancouver all the way up to St. John's, and they all provide critical equipment for the construction of ships. Wow. The only thing we don't currently build in Canada for ships are engines, but everything from bridge windows to navigation systems, they can all be done in Canada. So what we're trying to bring to the fore is we're trying to be a catalyst to bring a coherent plan together so that we, in a deliberate fashion, we make sure that there's a pan-Canadian response. That we marry up the needs of the Northerners who are driving this with the ability of Southern companies to provide But the aspiration is that we bring more and more northerners into the marine trades such that they can operate the ships and they can also benefit from it all.
Do we export those materials as well to other countries that are building icebreakers?
Well, we used to, and one of our initiatives right now is to build up our experience and make Canada, get it back into exporting ships. And worldwide, icebreaking fleets are getting older, so we're quite keen on exploiting that. But part of that means that you're the best at what you do. So that takes everything from ice pilots to engineers. But absolutely, the idea to export this technology down the road is a win-win for everyone.
So we've been sort of talking about it throughout, but I want to actually turn to this now. You've recently announced the creation of the Davie Arctic Icebreaker Center. That's in Quebec. Can you tell me a little bit more about it and why it's important?
Yes. Yeah, so I was mentioning a moment ago in the Senate report, it talks about there's, 17 federal government departments and agencies working in the north. Wow. And Davie is effectively the de facto icebreaking center today. We are in the process of the first icebreaker to be delivered to the Coast Guard in 25 years was done by Davie with Molly Cool, which has gone on to great success. She's going to be coming back in for some more conversions. But she was literally acquired and put right into service. And then we've got two more. And then there's six program icebreakers that have to be built. So what we looked at is it's been about a year that we've been studying the National Icebreaking Center. And we launched it recently, as you pointed out. But the idea is to be a catalyst. We want to bring focus on this very important part of a more general discussion on infrastructure. And we don't want to leave it and then find ourselves in extremists rushing to get things done. So the current government's done some modifications to the national shipbuilding strategy, which we support. They've done some fine-tuning of requirements, but the biggest thing they've done is recognize that there's such a demand for new shipping for the federal government agencies and departments that they had to bring Davie into the mix because we represent about over 50% of Canada's shipbuilding capacity. And we'd already been producing, for example, a lot of people don't know, but the first two ice-breaking, ice-capable ferries in North America that are LNG-powered were built at Davie and are currently in service in Quebec. So we think that going forward, the reality is today our suppliers know this, the community knows this. We want to articulate to the wider community that, hey, if you've got cool technologies that you think have an application up north, if you're a young Inuit and you're looking for a career that pays well and is very rewarding, you can, train to be an ice pilot or a mariner for an icebreaker. And if you're a supplier, here's a market that we can really push. So we're really excited. And so far, we've had a lot of input from other players, both governmental from the north and from the south. And so we're looking forward to getting going along this journey.
Is there sort of incentives in place to get northerners to come to this center as well? Like you were saying, bringing engineers or people who are studying. Is there any kind of effort in place to bring those people in?
Absolutely. So we're not trying to recreate the wheel. There's some fantastic work already being done. We're trying to bring focus on it. So, for example, Memorial University and the Arctic College are already getting young northern youth interested in the trades. And yet what's really interesting amongst our northern communities is that they're actually already, very open to the oceans and to the marine trades. Because when you think about the settlement patterns up north, people live beside the Arctic Ocean, whether it's water or ice in the winter. So what's fun is that, you know, people can see that there's a future there and, you know, gainful future employment. So yes, we've got three pillars of activity. We've got development of HR, human resources, whether it be mariners, engineers, the second pillar is technologies that are applicable for icebreaking in the north. And then the third is working with subcontractors that are already producing and equipment here in Canada. And we're a launching pad for them to perfect their equipment and get it into wider, you know, worldwide markets. And I'll give you an example. So there's a great little company out of Montreal that is in unmanned vehicles. And their technology is being used already in a nascent phase to assist icebreakers to fly ahead of the icebreaker to take a look at the ice. And the extreme environment to the north, when you look at battery technology, it doesn't operate that well in extreme cold. However, this little company has perfected some power management systems that optimize lithium ion batteries. Well, if you're a company working in the US or Europe where you're focused on a commercial market, you're not going to be worried about extreme cold. So there's a perfect example of how we're trying to be a catalytic force to this company has reached out to us already, and we've said, look, this is great. You know, this is exactly the type of thing that we have to nurture going forward.
The Arctic Icebreaking Center, it sounds like, is really engaged in having a vision for the Arctic. And I think at Arctic 360, we're working on a project that also envisions Canada as a leader in the Arctic by 2050. I just sort of wanted to ask you, in your mind, you know, what does that look like? What types of things do we need to prioritize and project now, you know, to sort of prepare Canada for leadership in 30 years down the line?
Well, it you know, Erica, that's a complex issue, as you know. I think there's a few things that we have to be very mindful of. First of all, is to have a proper, group of stakeholders at the table. We cannot continue having people in the south dictate to people in the north what we're doing. And frankly, as you probably know, northerners won't accept that anymore. I think, you know, that has to happen. The second thing is the quality of life Canada, in my opinion, cannot afford or cannot accept, rather, that we have a bifurcated standard of living in Canada, where we've got people in the south enjoying a great, you know, first world level of services provided to them by their government, and we've got people in the north who've got a housing crisis, who aren't, you know, we're burning diesel, we've got, they don't have access to the basic elements that we take for granted in the south. Right. So when you look forward to 2050, one of the things that the National Icebreaker Center is doing with Arctic 360 is that we're getting a bunch of thought leaders together, and we're going to do exactly what you were just asking, and that is envisioning where we want to be and what we think are going to be the influencers, the issues in 2050, and how do we get there? Right. And what do we have to put in place now? So a little less, you know, come out with very solid recommendations and try to stay away from platitudes and grand ideas, but try to fix some of the issues today that put the wheels in motion so we're ready in 2050.
What role, I guess, do icebreakers play into that vision?
Well, it's there's a huge role. So, for example, right now we've got we know, for example, that there's going to be more traffic through the Northwest Passage. There will be escort requirements. There will be search and rescue requirements. There will be continued demands for supply. So trying to marry up what we think are the needs with what can be produced. And the best example I keep coming back to is, you know, in in the south, we have the St. Lawrence Seaway, and we've got a very effective pilot association or organization. And for some of the listeners, I don't mean aircraft pilots. I mean the actual people you take on board a ship that help you navigate the waters, who've got the local knowledge. And these are master mariners who are experts. But it takes 30 years to obtain the skill sets and the experience to fill that role. So for example, we know that ice pilots to go navigate through the Northwest Passage will be critical, because we don't have the same level of fidelity in the hydrographic realm that we do in the south. So, you know, the importance of an ice pilot in the north is going to be enormous. We've already got some great ice pilots, but if the demand goes up, which we know it will, then we need more capable people. So we think, as an example today, that getting as many Inuit and Northerners into the marine trades, such that there's a coterie of properly trained people in 2050, is awesome. And you know, these are extremely well-paying jobs. They're rewarding. And if we don't get organized and we don't have our act together, there's a strong risk that we'll see a lot. You know, if you're living in a northern community and you see all these ships going by, and there won't be any economic benefit for the locals. So we see this as a time, you know, the Senate's report talks about a wake-up call. You know, people in industry are saying, look, it's time. Let's get ourselves organized. Let's work with the Northerners. Let's make sure that they're in the driving seat. But, you know, Canada can do better.
I have one last question, and it's sort of tied into that. I'm, you know, a policy student, and I feel like a lot of people don't really think about the Arctic when it comes to policy or a career choice. What would be your pitch for young people to sort of pivot their research and their attention towards the Arctic?
Well, I think from a career perspective, I think there's a huge opportunity, and that goes across the board, not just for people doing research and analysis, but for business. And I think, you know, I certainly don't want to sound like a nativist or someone who's, you know, solely focused on Canada, but I think there's enough opinion now of people saying, look, let's get our house in order. It's great to be out in as a pluralist working internationally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it stands to logic that if we don't sort out our own problems, we're kind of a hollow shirt if we start preaching to other countries what they should be doing. Right. So I think, you know, the National Icebreaking Center, for example, as I said, like we're already in the process of building icebreakers. We want to engage the wider community to make them Canadian solutions to Canadian problems. We don't need to always consult to the nth degree and ask everyone else what they're doing. We've got experts in the north who can tell us what they need, and I think that's what we're trying to do. Now, let's focus. Look, Erica, you're at a great time in your career. There's so much excitement about the north, and I think building the excitement is that. So, and I think also giving economic opportunity to some of the youth in the north and highlighting that they can have a great career. I think we need that. I mean, the social situation in the north, some of the issues are terrible and everyone's aware of them. And so we see our role as also being able to, you know, be cheerleaders to say, look, you can have a great career. So we're moving that way.
Reframing the north as an opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's where your organization comes in and others. But it's a key, I think, element.
Awesome. Okay, well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Spencer, okay. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, you're more than welcome, and thank you for listening to me and having the opportunity to talk about the National Icebreaking Center. So thank you very much.
A huge thanks once again to Spencer Fraser for joining me today. Stay tuned for next week. We're going to talk about mining in the North. See you then.